Hi, this is Joan Renner from Deranged LA Crimes in Los Angeles, California, and you're listening to Gangland Wire.
So when they take the silver dollar, they gotta go around different banks and cash it in.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. Welcome to another one of our media and the mob episodes. I'm here in the classic old Ice House building, as usual, in Midtown Kansas City. Sitting here right across the table from my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, tonight we have a special treat from the East Coast. You know, I deal a lot with Chicago and Las Vegas and Kansas City because that's kind of where my knowledge base is. And tonight we've got Dave Schrattweiser from Philadelphia. Dave, welcome to the show. Welcome to Gangland Wire.
Aaron and Gary, thanks for having me on. I greatly appreciate that. It's nice to be with you guys.
All right, Dave, as we talked before, what we want to deal with is your experiences in covering the mob. We've talked to Bulldog John Drummond up in Chicago. He is a character, and he is Mr. Uh-huh. Outfit in Chicago. I'm sure you probably know him, don't you?
I have heard the name. Yes, I have heard it. Well, I've been covering Philadelphia for almost 40 years now. I've been a reporter for 42 30-some-odd years here in the Philadelphia market and covering organized crime here in Philadelphia, which is a big deal here, back through the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, part of my career. The organized crime family here in Philadelphia has been around for a long, long time, well over 50 or 60 years, and there's a lot of, I don't want to say rich tradition, but tradition and organized crime family operations here in Philadelphia that go on to this very day, in which right now, I believe we have as many made guys on the street here in Philadelphia because they're all back out of prison as we've had probably in the last 30 or 40 years. But organized crime has always been something I wanted to sink my teeth into, so to speak, as a reporter. I ended up covering it just because of general assignment reporting when I first started in television. And I've had the good fortune to good friends with George Anastasia, who covered organized crime and crime for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's my partner on Mob Talk, and we do a lot of things together, and some TV shows, some radio stuff. We lecture before law enforcement officers and other groups around the East Coast, always talking about organized crime along with drug gangs and everything else you can imagine that is organized crime, whether big O, big C, or small O and small C. So that's kind of my background. We have a new show that we're doing now on Mob Talk. We used to do it on Fox 29, where I work for my regular job, but we do Mob Talk now on YouTube, and you can catch us on Mob Talk. It's called The Sit Down, and we've had about 8 episodes on now. We started back in August redoing it and kind of talking everything that's current, and we have some pretty good episodes coming up in the next few months. But it's my pleasure, Gary, to be on your show tonight. I've heard a lot about you from everybody I know here in Philadelphia who knows you and speak very highly of you.
Thanks a lot, Dave. I think, Aaron, you have a question over there?
I'm just kind of curious if you maybe know a friend of ours, Jerry Williams from the FBI. She worked
Jerry Williams,
in Philadelphia.
Jerry used, yeah, absolutely. I know Jerry for a long time, probably somewhere around 20 years. She was the press spokesperson for the FBI office here in Philadelphia, and I had, I don't want to say daily contact with her, but probably several times a week for years. Jerry's now kind of retired from the FBI. She went over to SEPTA to be there. That's our Southeastern transportation group here in Philadelphia. They run all the trains and buses in the area. And Jerry retired from there about a year ago and kind of doing her own adventures now, writing books. She's got a podcast, I think, website, all kinds of stuff. But I do know Jerry for a long time when she worked with the FBI. I worked very closely with her on a lot of big stories, some of them involving the mob. But great person to be around. I know Gary knows her as well.
Yeah, I would imagine that you were probably trying to use her as a source whenever they were uncovering that strip club corruption in Philadelphia. That was a heck of a story there.
Yeah, there's been a lot of good stories that Jerry has worked on over the years. I think you've seen some of her stuff that she's done recently. But Jerry was always very forthcoming as a FBI spokesperson. I don't want to say she was a source. I would say she was somebody we just go to get a comment or get information or whatever. And, she was always straightforward with us and very, very good. She made quite a mark at the FBI here and raised the bar kind of on public information officers. They've had a couple of since who've been very good, and I believe they ended up being as good as they were thanks to Jerry's kind of, setting the tone and making the path for him, that kind of thing.
And you know, that's one thing that I've been stressing as I've done each one of these interviews is how important the media is to help in the fight against organized crime and corruption in these big cities, because the only reason that they can operate is in secrecy. Otherwise, once you start turning a little light on them, the people get incensed. They don't really want to get involved. A lot of them, they like to buy something that fell off a truck. They like to go to a strip club, maybe. They like to gamble. They like to be able to make a bet on the Philadelphia Eagles and not have to go out to Las Vegas to do it. And the mob supplies all those things. But then when they find out exactly how the mob operates, they all of a sudden back off with their support. And when they find out how they corrupt politicians and get these kind of sweetheart deal contracts, and I noticed that you started in New Jersey and they had all that mob involved and kind of reported on Sopranos a little bit in fiction. Art imitates life, as the mob was involved in dumping medical waste over there in New Jersey. Did you get into any of that?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I was a print reporter and then a reporter for New Jersey Network News, I did a lot of coverage of the organized crime. I was actually an environmental reporter at some point, and I broke a big case many years ago. I received one of the top Environmental Protection Agency awards for reporting on the environment, for breaking a case where medical waste was washing up at the New Jersey shore, down at the beaches. And the waste was coming out of a New York City sanitation barge dumping operation that went on up in Gravesend Bay, which is right underneath the Verrazano Bridge leading into New York and from Staten Island. And we tracked the stuff to there and did a big undercover thing. And the state attorney general's office and the FBI ended up raiding the place. And they installed some big safeguards after we did that. I think they charged a few people as well to make sure that kind of thing didn't happen. But I covered the mob in New Jersey for a lot of years, too, because I started as a print reporter over there first and started shining a little bit of light on the mob, as you say. And today, I think if you talk to any of the wise guys here in Philadelphia, they'll tell you I'm a real thorn in their side, because we try and search out the kinds of things that they're up to. And, they've gone from everything from gambling with video poker machines to prostitution, drug running, all those kind of things throughout the years. Murder, obviously. Everything from stealing property and baby milk, bicycles, you name it, shipments of those kind of things, and then reselling them on the street. These days, they're into all kinds of things, from LED lighting to safety training academies for construction sites. They're into house flipping, if you know what that is. Up old houses, renovating them, getting mortgages blown out on them, and then selling them off and kind of gouging the mortgage right out from under the house. They've done all kinds of things like that, and it's been going on now, and they're kind of going legit here, or at least on the surface trying to look like they're legit. At the same time, they continue to do some of their old staples, which is the gambling, loan sharking, all that kind of stuff, stolen property. They still do those kinds of things. I will say that the violence in Philadelphia has died down since about 2005. We've only seen one mob murder since then. That was a couple of years ago. And one of the individuals involved in that is now doing 30 to life. But these are not the days that Angelo Bruno kind of oversaw, and then Nicky Scarfo, who was probably the most violent crime boss in Philadelphia during the 80s. I think there were upwards of 25 murders during his reign in Philadelphia. He recently died in prison after I think he had served maybe 30 years of a life term. But some of his top lieutenants now back on the street here in Philadelphia, and they are one faction of the mob here. They do not get along with the other faction of the mob, which is mob boss Joey Merlino's faction. He's a big social media front page guy. He's under indictment in New York now in a big racketeering case in there, and he goes on trial in January. But he was one of the big names in a racketeering indictment that came out a year ago, August. And he is one of three guys that have not pled guilty and will stand trial in January. But all his factions out there, the Joseph Legambi faction is out there. He ran the mob when Joey Merlino went to jail. And some of the old Nicky Scarfo guys are back on the street. So we have probably 30 to 35 made guys back on the streets operating here in Philadelphia. Some of them have gone legit. They've opened restaurants, businesses, real estate stuff that's at least on the surface appears to be legit. Nobody's been charged with any crime. So everybody seems to be trying to make money these days. Let's put it that way. And the mob is always about making money and greed. As you well know, Gary.
I know. You know, that's interesting about no mob hits, first of all. That seems to be pretty much nationwide as I watch the headlines and look for other stories to talk about on my podcast here. And certainly our experience in Kansas City, we have not had the last mob hit must have been 20 years ago. And then same way in Chicago, I've watched that very close, and they haven't done that. We also, the last time we had some Kansas City guys got popped in a sports gambling ring. They just pled guilty. They got about 3 years. They didn't get a lot of time, and they just pled guilty. Now, back in the day, you know, there was a couple of witnesses out there back in the day. One of those witnesses would have disappeared more than likely or ended up dead, one of the two. So, that's the modern mob has changed immensely throughout.
One of the people that Jerry Williams used to work with is Barry Gross. He's a former U.S. attorney. He was on the organized crime strike force here for years. He retired from the U.S. attorney's office. He's now a private attorney. But he always described gambling as the spoke that made the wheel go round.
Yeah, that's for sure.
If they didn't do gambling and loan sharking, they didn't make any money.
Yeah.
And these days, you know, a lot of legalized gambling is out there. We have casinos here in the Pennsylvania, Philadelphia area. We have them in Atlantic City, which is just a 45 or 50-minute ride from Philadelphia. So there's a lot of legalized gambling. Delaware has gambling as well. So that's out there. But the gambling business has died down. And the pie, the big pie of money that the mob used to carve up, has also shrunk big time here in Philadelphia. And you know, it's the kind of situation where there's just not that much money out there. So they've had to branch out into other things, and like they have up and down the East Coast, they're in the trash business. They're in, any kind of waste hauling business. They're in all kinds of things. Anything they can get their hands into, more and more legit businesses these days than, you know, you would think. But the bottom line here is they're still out there to make money. They still like to scheme and do their thing. And, it's my job as a reporter, George Anastasia's job when he was with the Philadelphia Inquirer, and even today he writes for a lot of different publications in addition to working on Mob Talk with me. He's written 7 or 8 books, George. And if you haven't read them, I recommend you do. His name is George Anastasia. He's a former Philadelphia Inquirer guy. Blood and Honor is a favorite of mine. The Last Gangster is another one. That's about Ron Previty, who wore a wire for the FBI. He was a mob captain, a former cop here in Philly. He just recently passed away about a month ago, but he made well over 200 tapes in the last big mob case here in Philadelphia and put a lot of guys away, and then continued to live in the area, as have several other mob cooperators still live in the Philadelphia area, some of them as close as 45 minutes away from here. Nothing happens to them at this point. It just doesn't happen. Nobody goes after those guys anymore. Those days are over about killing government witnesses or trying to get them not to talk. Just as the murders have calmed down, they've also calmed down in that area. They know those are the kind of crimes that send them away for 30-plus years. And I mentioned the Scarfo crime family guys that are out of jail. Most of those guys did 28 to 30 years in prison. And the last thing they want to do is go back to jail.
Yeah, I've noticed in over my lifetime of being involved in the criminal justice system, the great Well, the one factor in recidivism, not going back to the penitentiary, is age. After a guy gets to a certain age, he does not want to go back. Young guy will go back, figure he can do it. Like a guy told me once, said, man, he said, I can do a tray stand in my head. Go ahead, send me away. But when they get to be 15, 60 years old, they start thinking twice. So,
and that's where we're at right now. The whole Joey Merlino mob, Gary, is all in their mid-50s. Some of them are pushing into their 60s. The Scarfo guys are all late 50s into their mid-60s. The last thing they want to do is go do a 12-year bid or a 15-year or 20-year sentence. They don't want to do that. So anything they get involved with, I'm going to say, is probably on the white-collar end of things in times of crime, because the last thing they want to do is grab off a 20-year prison sentence at this point in their lives. Plus, they've come home. It's a good life. Cell phones, computers, things they never had in the 80s. And when they were out there, some of these guys had to come home and learn how to use a cell phone.
Yeah, really?
I mean, they had never seen those kind of things, that kind of thing. So the mob has definitely changed, and as they change, we change. We do a lot of undercover work here in Philadelphia. We do a lot of surveillance work for organized crime figures, and we kind of fill up the box on a story, keep putting evidence like the FBI does. We keep putting elements for a story in a box, and when that box fills up and we got enough to make a good story, we put together a nice 5 or 6 minute piece and put it on television, and then lots of people like to watch it. Like The Sopranos, there's always a healthy appetite for stories about the mob. As you well know, there's a couple big movies coming out. The John Gotti movie, Robert De Niro's making a movie right now based on the murder of Jimmy Hoffa and Frank Sheeran, who was a union leader here in Philadelphia. We got the Gotti movie coming out pretty soon in December. Trailers are out on that now. That'll probably do well. It's John Travolta playing John Gotti. So, you know, there's always an appetite for that. It's not always news. Sometimes it is entertainment, but it's worth reporting on and kind of keeping an eye on. I think we have to do that as journalists, you know, keep an eye on, as we do drug gangs and other organized crime groups. We have a large Russian organized crime operations here in Philadelphia. We have Albanian organized crime here in Philadelphia. We have drug gangs that are run by guys from the Dominican Republic who basically run the heroin trade here in Philadelphia. That kind of situation. We have a huge problem with heroin in our metropolitan area here. A lot of young people dying from overdoses from heroin. Those things are not controlled by the mob anymore. They're controlled by other groups, and we do a lot of stories about them daily, and, you know, long range kind of reporting stuff. But we keep an eye on all of those groups as we kind of, you know, keep the spotlight on organized crime in Philadelphia.
Well, Dave, from a personal aspect, yeah, I mean, you, especially the mob guys, you may be eating at the same restaurant or maybe having a drink after work at the same bar where some of these guys might show up. You got any, you have any personal stories about that? Any run-in, bump-ins with some of these guys?
Oh, I get my my share of, you know, I drive around sometimes in a, because I'm a reporter for Fox News here in Philadelphia as well. That's my everyday job. But I drive around in a live truck, you know, with the name Fox all over the side of it. And, you know, I have been here for a long time, so I have a bit of a reputation on the street for being, you know, tough on crime and tough on criminals and tough on organized crime. So I get my share of F-bombs and things like that as I drive by. And I've been in restaurants where guys have, you know, come over, they're a little bit social, and then, you know, you can hear them talking across the room. I've only had a situation maybe twice in my whole career where I've actually had my life threatened. Once was a big demolition operation here in Philadelphia that was demolishing buildings, and a guy involved with that group had threatened to kill me and my cameraman because we were working on an undercover operation with him. He was not involved in organized crime, but that's a situation that had developed. I've been threatened a few times with a good beating, not to my face, but through other people, but the information came to me that, you know, somebody had threatened me. And I know a lot of people in law enforcement. I actually at one point worked for the Attorney General's office in New Jersey as a director of communications for the Attorney General for 2 years. So I got to see the law enforcement side. And, you know, I have a lot of friends who are police officers, FBI agents, and other types of federal agents. And to my amazement, they kind of stepped up one time when I got a threat like that and stepped to one of the mob guys and basically told him, you know, one hair on his head, one flat tire, one broken window, and the first person we're going to come knocking on his door is going to be you. So, you know, I have the good fortune of having a lot of good friends in law enforcement, and that has kind of helped me along the way. But generally, they don't do that kind of thing with me. They're usually, hey, you know, hello, goodbye kind of situation. A lot of guys like to talk to me, try and pick my brain about what I know and kind of what's going on kind of thing, because I guess they think they're getting some kind of information out of me. But everything I know, I usually report on television or on Mob Talk. So there are no secrets with me. We talk. We have a conversation. It usually ends fairly well. But I try and keep a handshake kind of relationship with them, just to civil about it if we can. But, you know, sometimes it doesn't end that way, and it ends in a shouting match or, you know, somebody cursing me out. But that's something you have to deal with. You have to have a thick skin when you're a reporter. There's no doubt about that.
Well, civil when you're, you know, sticking a camera and a microphone in a guy's face, and he doesn't want any of that kind of coverage going on.
Philly mob guys are a little different, especially the Joey Merlino crew. They love the media. He's one of the only mob guys, bosses you'll ever see on social media. He's got an Instagram page. He's on Twitter. You see him on Facebook. he does not shy away from that. It's incredible how much media coverage he actually gets. When he was told by a judge he couldn't go to a wedding in Boca Raton, Florida, where he lives now, because another mob guy was there, it was like front page news in Miami and then front page news up here and then front page news in New York, because he's under indictment in New York in a big racketeering case. But one thing Joey Merlino, who's the current boss of the mob, according to the FBI, one thing he never shies away from is publicity. I actually have heard guys tell me that he thinks publicity is good, that if people know who he is and he's in charge, they'll listen when he talks. And I think he has, in his career since the early 80s to now, I don't think he ever shied away from the media at all. And I mean, if you ever saw the guy, he's kind of the John Gotti of Philadelphia. He's well-dressed, handsome young guy. He's in his mid-50s. And again, never afraid of the media, embraces those situations, and just kind of keeps moving.
You know, I wondered. I see on these different mob interest Facebook fan pages, he is all over the place. Pictures of him every which way. And it's like I didn't really realize that before, but and he's like, he always looks like a model or a TV, more like a TV actor of some kind. Like he's a guy playing a part in The Sopranos. This is the way he always looks to me. So that's interesting. Yeah. I didn't understand that about him.
They used to call John Gotti the Dapper Don. I would say Joey's the Dapper Don of Philadelphia. He's also the Teflon Don, by the way. He's beaten about 4 or 5 murder cases here in Philadelphia. Those kind of cases just kind of bounce off the guy. But somebody said he doesn't have like 12 lives; he's got like 20 lives.
Really,
you know, he's one of these guys that he's done prison. He's done prison sentences and things like that. But you could see him out in a nightclub with his picture being taken. He's gotten his picture taken with hockey players, basketball players, movie stars, rap artists. You name it. He's been around them, and he's had his picture taken with them, and they're all over social media. You know, you can look them up. Just Google Joey Merlino, and you'll probably see 100 images pop up. I would venture to say 80 of them were taken by myself or my camera guys from work because of chronicling kind of his activity over the last 20 or 25 years or so.
I'm just thinking, has he done a podcast? Maybe we could talk to him.
Yeah, has Skinny Joe done a podcast? We could be guests on there.
I'll see if I can get him on with you, Gary.
If you talk to him, tell him. We like to hear out of the mouths of the men that did it. We've had a convicted skyjacker. We've had Frank Culotta, really a hit man and a convicted burglar.
Small-time drug dealer.
Small-time drug dealer on
so
here.
Listen, I'll put a little plug in. I'll put a little plug in. We have a Mob Talk coming up. It should be out sometime over the weekend. It'll be called Mob Talk Sit Down Number 8
okay.
on YouTube. We have a guy who's a made guy in Philadelphia. Who no longer lives in the Philadelphia area. We have him all kind of blocked out, changed his voice and everything like that. And we talk about a mob hit that it's the only videotaped mob hit that the FBI's ever recorded. It was recorded with a poll camera outside a place called the Warfield Diner back in, I believe it was 1993.
Wow.
And the FBI not only had a bug in the place for audio, but they had a video camera, and it shows the gunman driving up in front, getting out of the car, running inside. You hear the screams of a woman and then the screams of a guy who was in there. They were trying to whack the then boss of the mob, John Stanfa, but he wasn't there. His top captain was there, and they ended up shooting that guy five times and almost shot the woman as well. But they have the audio and the video from that, and that'll be in this piece we got coming up, and you'll hear from a mob guy, although we don't reveal his identity. You'll hear some kind of firsthand accounts on why they did that murder, what they were trying to accomplish with it, and how they bungled it because they didn't get who they wanted in that hit. And wow. There's a lot of those kind of hits here in Philadelphia, you know, where they've kind of bumbled their way through it.
You know, here in Kansas City, they never bumbled one. They took a couple of risks running into bars and shooting people, but they never bumbled one. They came close once, but they never bumbled one. And I've sat on those, not on the audio, but on the poll camera. I could imagine they had the audio too, those agents sitting on the and watching that go down like,
oh
my God, what do we do?
Yeah, it's like shadowy figures.
Really?
Yeah, you see two cars pull up and you see these shadowy figures run out. They go in and then the audio comes up. You hear the gunfire inside the place. You see them run out and the cars drive off. It's literally, I believe, the only mob hit ever caught on tape. Now, the guy didn't die.
Yeah.
He suffered like five gunshot wounds. He's been seriously injured because of it. All the way to this day, he's still alive. But that, I believe, was the only mob hit ever caught on videotape and audio at the same time. And it's pretty incredible. And if you want, tune into Mob Talk over the weekend on Live Talk, on YouTube. And you'll be able to, you know, check it out. It's pretty good. You'll be very interested if you get a chance to see that video I'm talking about.
I'll do it. How did you snag that mob guy? I mean, that's quite a coup. Is he in the witness protection program, or is he going to be a witness, or...?
I can't say too much about the guy because I don't want to give away who the guy is, but I have known the guy on and off for about 20 years. I know a lot of different organized crime figures here in Philadelphia who ended up being cooperators, and they live all over the country. I did a piece, a five-part series with a guy named John Beese, and I actually co-authored a book called The Hitman, and he was perhaps the best government witness I've ever seen testify. He was a captain in the Philadelphia mob under John Stanfa, and they tried to kill him, and he turned on the Philly mob. He ended up testifying against John Stanfa and his organized crime family and ended up putting close to 30 guys behind bars, including Stanfa, for five life terms. And John, they call him John Beese, now lives somewhere in America. He's actually a car salesman, and he's a damn good one. He's one of the top sales guys in the state he lives in. But the interesting thing is, the day he was supposed to testify against John Stanfa, the Philly mob went and whacked his brother left his house in South Philadelphia and drove down the block. They had two gunmen, one on each side of the street, and as he got to the corner, they filled up his Chevy Blazer with about 20 shots, ended up killing his brother. That was Billy Veazey. And John Veazey, they took a recess in the case for a couple of days, but the following Monday he got on the stand and he literally buried John Stanfa and the Stanfa mob here in Philadelphia. And you know, his brother Billy lost his life tragically in that situation, but that was one of the more notorious mob hits in Philadelphia because it was right smack in the middle of the John Stanfa racketeering and extortion trial here in Philadelphia. It was front page news, I would say, Gary, probably for 2 weeks.
Yes, that's amazing. That is amazing. To compare and contrast, in 77, 78, our boss, a guy named Nick Savella, was in jail. He had gone back for a 2 year bit on a old gambling charge that he'd fought off for a long time, and he was getting ready to get out. And there was two or three people that. They needed to do something about, and the word came out. Well, actually, they taped him talking to his brother, and said, "I want all that business taken care of before I get out. So when I get out, then it'll look like, you know, when I'm out, things calm down." So, you know, it's the exact opposite of killing somebody in the middle of a trial, a brother to the witness. That is, yep. That is audacious. That is, I don't know. I just can't believe
it. We've actually had that happen now a couple of times. Yeah, a couple of times in Philly. There's a guy named Anthony Tura. It was Tony Tura. And he was on trial with a bunch of other organized crime figures. And in the middle of his trial, he walked out the front door of his home, and a couple of hitmen took him out, like, wow, in the middle of his trial. And it's not that that's the second or third time. It's kind of actually become a little bit of a trademark here. Nobody's ever been convicted of that crime or the Billy Veazey murder. So those cases kind of still sit out there. Whether we'll ever see him again in a federal indictment, I don't know. But it's happened at least twice. And, you know, the timing sometimes here in Philadelphia on mob hits, everybody thought John Stanfa had killed Billy Veazey so that his brother wouldn't testify against him. In the last big round of indictments, they actually accused the Joey Merlino faction of killing Billy Veazey. They were not convicted of that. The jury came back, I believe, not proven, which is kind of an odd verdict, and it remains open as to whether they could charge that case again. But nobody's ever been convicted of that murder, but everybody thought it was coming from Stanfa to get John Veazey not to testify against him. And at the end of the day, the accusations by the FBI and the allegations by them was that was actually carried out by the Joey Merlino organized crime faction here in Philadelphia, who Stanfa was at war with at that time.
Yeah, sounds like they did it in order to help bury Stanfa. That's a pretty tough mob back there in Philly.
That might have been their motivation. But let's put it this way again: nobody's ever been convicted of that, so it might be allegations and accusations, but still no convictions on that.
Now that's the trouble with some of those mob hits. Sometimes it's just some old grudge or some other thing that you don't know anything about, over money or some perceived slight that nobody but a couple of people know anything about, and it just happens to be at the same time something else is going on, because ain't nobody talking. They don't publish a schedule of events with a playbook of what they're doing. So you just never know.
We call it a murder for all reasons.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good one.
It's a murder for all reasons.
They don't have it.
Personal, could be mob related, could maybe not, could be a girlfriend, it could be a lot of different things. You know what I'm saying? A murder for all reasons, we like to say.
Seems like a lot of, I know you kind of like your Chicago mob, guy will catch a case and the family, the outfit, gets nervous that they're going to talk and then they put a hit out on him.
We've had that kind of situation. We've had quite a history of cooperators. One of them is Philip Leonetti. He was the nephew of mob boss Nicky Scarfo. His book is called The Mafia Prince. It's done very well. It's been out there. It's written by a guy out of Detroit and a guy from here in the Philadelphia area. He was a big cooperator. He did 18 or 19 murders, testified against his uncle, and only did 5 years in prison. We've had Tommy Del Giorno, who also flipped on Nicky Scarfo. He also was a top captain. Nick Caramondi, Ron Previty, John Veazey, Tommy Scafidi, Ralph Natal. We had the first mob boss in the country flip and cooperate with the FBI here in Philadelphia. In fact, I just did a big piece with Ralph, because he has a book out called The Last Don. It's a pretty good book. It's a kind of a firsthand account of his life in the Philadelphia mob and that kind of thing. But he was the first mob boss to flip. He spent 8 days on the witness stand, 2 on direct examination and almost 6 on cross-examination. He's been taken all over the place. He's been vilified by the organized crime figures here, all that kind of stuff. There's been some other cooperators too, but we have a history here in Philadelphia, a rich history, if you want to call it that, of organized crime figures flipping and testifying against their mates. I think in one trial, we actually had 4 guys who were cooperators testify against the organized crime figures who were on trial. All cooperative witnesses who used to be made guys in the Philly mob.
Well, you know, Dave, that's amazing. In Kansas City, we've never had anybody of any note that actually testified. They had one real low-level guy that helped with the skim trial out of Las Vegas, but he wasn't even really from Kansas City now. And my good friend and the case agent for that straw man case or the Las Vegas skimming case still lives here in Kansas City. And we were talking about this, and he thinks that it's because Kansas City is such a small town that everybody's got these extended family members that are still out there and see each other at school, at church, and baseball, little league, basketball games, you know, and restaurants, that everybody, they'd be embarrassed, or they'd be embarrassing their family members who they would leave behind to be, you know, living down the street from whoever they flipped on. But we've never had anybody that there was a couple that gave a lot of information and then went in a witness protection program, but they were so low level that, you know, they weren't barely associates, what we'd call an associates. They were just professional criminals that happened to be in the right place at the right time. And Chicago, they haven't had many flip until lately.
We have, like I said, I could probably name a dozen made guys who have flipped from mob foot soldiers all the way up to a mob boss. Monprevity was a mob captain here in Philadelphia. John Vesey was a mob captain. One of those guys, Tommy Del Giorno, was one of the biggest organized crime figures in the old Nicky Scarfo era. He helped run methamphetamine and P2P here in Philadelphia. They used to import 55-gallon drums of P2P to help make methamphetamine. Methamphetamine was a big drug here in Philadelphia back in the 70s and the 80s, and it was home-cooked. It's not crystal meth like now. They had their own home-cooked version, and they were even into that kind of thing. But we've had a long, long history of having cooperators, not who just cooperated against the mob, but some guys who actually wore wires against their own guys. It's kind of a crazy thing to think about it. You know, some organized crime factions who've never had anybody turn on them, and then you have where, you know, sometimes the mob has been referred to as the mob who couldn't shoot straight. But they have, between the murders and the cooperators, you know, we have quite a history, and that's kind of why the mob continues to, you know, get headlines even to today. They always say, you know, why doesn't the federal government shift their resources and go after the terrorists and the drug gangs and all that kind of stuff? George Anastasia, my partner on Mob Talk on YouTube, likes to say, you know, they're kind of like domestic organized crime.
Yeah.
I mean, domestic terrorism, and you have to kind of keep an eye on them. You have to keep your finger on the pulse there, because when you let up, they get into all kinds of things. And you look at how many guys have been indicted out of New York, Philadelphia, Miami, Chicago, Kansas City, Detroit over the last 5 years. There's probably 400 or 500 guys who've been indicted. The Merlino indictment that Joey Merlino was currently in, 46 defendants in that case, including a Genovese crime family top guy. Other crime family guys were in that indictment. 46 guys got indicted last August, a year ago August.
Now that was
43 of them have pled guilty already.
I noticed that it was a Patsy Perello. I think he was a Genovese captain.
Yep, that's him.
And he pled guilty already. What do you think, Dave?
Yep, he has pled.
What do you think of the witness in that? I was reading about that case. That witness sounds a little bit shaky. I think that's probably why Merlino's going to go all the way to trial rather than copping a plea. The witness. What do you think of that cooperating witness?
John Rubio is the guy's name.
Rubio, right.
Yeah, the guy's name is John Rubio, yeah. J.R. is his nickname. He was kind of brought into this by Patsy Perillo out of the Genovese crime family out of New York, and he wore a wire up in New York for a long period of time and recorded information. There was a FBI undercover agent also worked in that case, but then Rubio went down to Florida, where Joey Merlino was living after he got out of prison after doing 13 years. By the way, he said he won that case, but he still did 13 years in jail. I don't know about that. But Rubio went down there to supposedly record conversations with Merlino. And then the problem that they ran into is he was not being monitored, allegedly, by the FBI every time he wore a wire or decided that he wasn't going to wear a wire to a particular meeting or social event or whatever. He also had his phone switched over somewhere in the middle of the operation, and some emails, text messages, phone messages and stuff were lost. And, you know, anytime you leave big gaps in recorded conversations or conversations that weren't recorded that should have been recorded, or the FBI wasn't there to monitor him when he went into an event and came out of an event. You know, this is FBI agent Dave Schrattweiser with, you know, undercover operative John Rubio. He's going to a meeting here at 10:10 at night at a restaurant, and he's going to record the conversation and come back out and then say, we've just finished recording a three-hour meeting with Joe Blow, and that's the way it goes in the logs.
Right.
And if it doesn't go in that way and it's not handled that way properly, when you go to court, defense attorneys will rip that witness apart, and he'll rip the FBI agents who supervised or didn't supervise those guys apart as well. And I think that's the fear in that case, because Rubio wasn't, according to what we've been told, properly managed, and he didn't record every conversation, or he turned the recorder off, those kind of things. When you do those kind of things and you kind of play loose with the recording situation, that ends up being problems, and that ends up being a big, huge element in, you know, taking that witness apart on the witness stand. And Joey Merlino's lawyer in this case is a guy named Edwin Jacobs. He's from Atlantic City. He's been trying mob cases for 30 years. He's one of the best damn lawyers I've ever seen at taking a witness apart, because he doesn't just listen to the part the government wants you to hear, that part of the tape. He wants you to hear what took place before that conversation and what took place after that conversation to give it context. And I would say 8 times out of 10, he's managed to kind of blow up a tape-recorded conversation because of what actually got said before or what got said after. He's the master of ripping apart government tapes, and he's done it many, many times in big cases here in Philadelphia. And I don't know. He's never had his day in court in New York, because he's not a New York attorney. He's a New Jersey and Pennsylvania attorney. But he is going to be first chair up in New York if Merlino goes to trial. That's January 18th, I believe. If he goes to trial, Jacobs will be the lead attorney with a New York attorney sitting next to him. But believe you me, when this goes to court and they try to take apart John Rubio on the stand or those tapes on the stand, it'll be Ed Jacobs kind of, you know, driving the bus in that kind of situation.
Well, most interesting. I'll be watching that trial. I've kind of been following it already. We did a podcast kind of on the, you know, what's the mob doing today, and here was an example. And so then I started following the news reports on that, and that's where I learned about Rubio and being a little bit of a shaky witness. So that makes sense. Aaron, you got any other questions before we let Dave go? We've kept him here quite a while.
I'm kind of looking here at your so this is most of your current coverage. You've got some books that you've written.
Yeah, I worked on one book called The Hitman. It was kind of the life and times of John Beese, the witness I was talking about before. We actually flew out to where he lives currently and spent some time with him, 2 or 3 days, and had him retell some stories about murders he was involved with, guys he was involved with on the street, and testifying on the witness stand. That was the one book I've helped write. My co-author in that was Ralph Cipriano. He did the bulk of the writing on that book. I supplied the information, kind of got the interview with VZ, because I knew VZ from the day he went to jail. Used to communicate with me via telephone on and off from jail and chat kind of thing. And we always talked about doing a book when he got out of prison, because he was, as I said, probably the best witness I've ever seen in an organized crime case. He literally had the jury eating out of his hand. And I'll tell you one quick funny story and then I'll go. When he was on the witness stand, one of the defense attorneys tried to pin him down. And you guys know what an FBI 302 form is. That's the form that the FBI writes down everything that a witness has said, and it's kind of his official statement on things. It's called an FBI 302. And a defense attorney was trying to punch holes in John Veazey's testimony. He was reading from a FBI 302, and Veazey was dressed in a blue suit with a nice red tie on up in front of the jury, and they asked him, the defense attorney says, it says here in your 302 that you used to feed live chickens to your dog, your Rottweiler dog, in a park across the street from your house. That you let these chickens run and then sick your dog on them, trying to make the guy look bad in front of the jury that he was an animal hater or, you know, that kind of thing. And John Veazey said, nope, that's not true. And the defense attorney thought he had a break in his testimony and walked up and says, well, it says right here in your FBI 302 that you fed your dog, your Rottweiler, live chickens. And he says, nope, that's not right. And he goes, so who's lying, the FBI or you? And he says, well, let me say this. They weren't live chickens. They were live roosters. And the entire jury cracked up. Even the judge had a smile on his face. But it just goes to show how far he would go to tell the jury the truth. So the guy was trying to taint him as an animal hater and maybe try and turn the jury against him. And he turned it right back around. The jury was falling out of their seats laughing. Live roosters.
Live roosters. Now, if I were the...
So that's my final funny story for the night there.
If I were the prosecutor, I would then get up on redirect and I would say, well, now, Mr. Beasley, do you eat chicken in a restaurant? Well, yeah. Well, how do you think that those chickens get on that plate at that restaurant? Well, I guess somebody has to raise them up and then kill them and then, you know, dress them out and cook them. And so anyhow, that would be I would rehabilitate
him. He had a big smile on his face after he after he told that story. Let me put it that. But he took the whole courtroom down and laughed.
Oh yeah, they didn't. The prosecutor didn't.
Crazy moment in that trial.
Really, he didn't have to rehabilitate him. He rehabilitated himself by making it into a humorous situation.
Leave it right there.
Yeah, that was for sure. All right, Dave. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the air here with us, and I will let you know when this is on. And I'm certainly going to watch that Mob Talk this weekend and keep following the Joey Merlino, Skinny Joe trial. I think unless Aaron's got something else here, we're going to let you go. Aaron's shaking his head no.
Guys, I really appreciate you guys having me on. Jerry Williams talks about you guys all the time. She said, you got to do their podcast.
All right.
I'm more than happy to do it, and I greatly appreciate the invitation from Kansas City to do it.
All right.
Thank you guys for having me on.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you so much.
Take care. All righty.
Good night.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Well, that guy, he was most interesting. He was like talking to another policeman.
Man.
an FBI agent. Boy,
you could tell he was a reporter.
Yeah, he is into it. Boy. That guy.
A lot of names and dates and facts, and he just fired him off there. I mean, it was
like he had a cheat sheet in front of him. I know he didn't, because this is all on the fly. He just got off of work and stepped into another room. He's on his way home from work now. I appreciate him giving us that time.
Yeah, I had a cheat sheet, and I couldn't follow along. The Borghazis and the...
The Borghazis and the Stanfas, John Stanfa.
The Scarfos. The thing is, we haven't... We've talked a little bit
about... We've not done anything about the Philly...
The Philadelphia mob.
The history on it. We need to do the history on it. We might get him back on and talk about the history of it all. I've read quite a little bit. There was quite the Nicky Scarfo with the Chicken Man Tesla... I can't remember the name of the Don before that war. Philadelphia, that mob family controls Atlantic City. Now, New York has had some rights down there as far as having action, but Philly was the control over Atlantic City, and all that gambling came in. If you remember, they had a meeting actually back in when Atlantic City was getting ready to open up to gambling.
Mm-hmm.
There was a meeting with Chicago and the New York families and probably the Philadelphia family more than likely, and they decided that Chicago, Kansas City would have Las Vegas and they would stay out, but they had exclusive rights to any action in Atlantic City. So there was a huge war within Philadelphia as that all that Atlantic City money started coming in, and they had that action going there and became much more important a part of their family. But they seem to fight among themselves over anything. I've read books on that. I just haven't done it in quite a while. I have to go back and refresh my memory. We'll do a whole show on the Philadelphia mob. I didn't realize. I didn't really realize it was ongoing after that Nicky Scarfo and the Chicken Man Tesla. There's a Bruce Springsteen song that talks about the Chicken Man getting blown up in Philadelphia, and that was part of that mob war back in the 70s.
Well, this is some of the most current stuff we've probably ever talked about.
Yeah, this is. Well, they're doing current stuff. They ain't doing current stuff in Kansas City. They're not doing, John Drummond said they're not doing much in Chicago, and I see a little bit, but not much, not to this extent, like what they're doing in Philly.
Maybe we can get that boss on, do a Snapchat with him or something.
Who?
Who was the Philadelphia guy, Tommy? That was, he said, was all into the social media.
Oh, yeah. Skinny Joe Molino. Yeah. Really. Well,
I go look him up on Twitter and follow him.
Well, that's what we'll do. We'll start looking a little closer at him. I didn't realize he was wanting to be out there quite so much. He may want to show these rubes out here in the Midwest as country hick mob guys and just what a cool, slick mob guy he is. You know, just play to his ego a little bit. And it is. You see these pictures. You know, folks, go out there, and if you haven't ever done it, if you don't follow mob stuff that close, just Google Joe Merlino, M-E-R-L-I-N-O, or Skinny Joe, and look at all the pictures and all the stuff and read up about him. He is quite a character. Plus, he did a deal with, as Dave said, he did this deal with Patsy Perello, that Genovese mob captain, on some action down in Florida. I can't remember the details of all what they were doing. I'd have to go back and look at my notes on that. But they had some kind of piece of action going with this John Rubio. This informant was running in between all of them and wearing a wire. So that will be an interesting trial to follow here in January.
It'd be interesting to talk to that attorney for the mob associates, the one that beats all those wiretap charges that they bring forward that used to convict the guys. He'd be interesting to talk to.
He would be.
I don't know if he'd talk to us, but
somehow I doubt it. He's still actively involved. It would not be good for his business. This is not the kind of advertising that he needs.
Well, you never know. You know, people that are criminals do Google their own name.
They don't want to Google their lawyer's name and find out he's out here talking about his work.
Like how good he is at doing it. And then they'll be like, well, I got to get him as my attorney because he's so good at getting guys off.
Yeah, well.
Well, you know what the alternative is when you're an attorney for the mob and you don't get your guys off.
Well, you probably don't get any more business. You think they kill him? I've never heard of it.
It hasn't happened?
Unless they were somehow involved in the action. They probably have been killed, but when you look at it a little bit deeper, you'll find they were not paying off some loan shark money, or they were involved in some kind of action. They cheated somebody, they screwed somebody over really bad. As long as you do a good job and don't cheat them on their money, you're going to be okay. It's kind of a normal kind of a lawyer-client relationship. I've played golf with a guy that he was talking about helping defend some Tuffy DeLuna, Carl DeLuna, and some of these guys back in the 70s in his firm. And he was kind of a junior associate back then, and some of the things that he did and talking with him and everything. And this guy's kind of a goof. So, he lived through it, and they all got found guilty and spent basically the rest of their lives in the penitentiary.
Yeah, maybe he didn't argue over his legal fees as much. Who knows? it seems like a hard-pressed case.
He couldn't argue. He was just part of a bigger firm. They're the ones that would have collected the legal fees. Now, Oscar Goodman, he's lost plenty of cases, and he always charged a decent legal fee, I'm sure. But like I said, as long as you treat it in a business-like manner and you're not involved with their business, even if you lose your case, nothing's going to happen to you. It's kind of like these reporters, although this guy has pushed it quite a little bit. So I would say that some of those threats he had, at least for a good beatdown, he might want to pay attention. He's kind of a big guy. I've seen him on that YouTube mob talk thing, and he's kind of a big guy and a forceful kind of guy, so...
Yeah, but I mean, and sure, he has some police officers that are friends, but you know, when danger is occurring, you know, when seconds count, usually cops are minutes away.
Yeah, they're minutes away. They're over at Chubby's waiting on their food, waiting on Aaron to bring out their food. Oh, just a minute. Aaron, can you go ahead and bring me those hash browns? I got to eat, and then I got to run out and save this guy. And Aaron's going, oh, I don't know, let me go check with the kitchen. You don't really get cops in there eating anymore, do you?
Not so much.
Probably used to. You still got that guy in the morning that comes in the morning? Still come in every morning?
Richard. Yeah,
I can't figure out who that guy is.
Detective.
I'm sure I know him. Did he say he knew me?
Yeah, because he spun the paper around that one morning they were talking about Frank's uncle getting shot and killed all those years ago. And it's like, well, there's Gary Jenkins' name.
Yeah, he's a little bit, he's younger than I am because he's still on. And a lot of younger people I didn't really know that well. All right, Aaron. I think I'll do my public service announcement now so we can get on out of here. If you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to go out and get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase on Amazon or rent, but you're going to want to buy that because you'll watch that, and then when you get the app, Kansas City Mob Tour, and take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City, you're going to want to go back and look at the movie and listen to some of those scenes because they're the words from the mouth of the men that did it. And then get the latest from Gary Jenkins, his book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And if you're so inclined, you could become a made member of Gangland Wire. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button.
And go back and look at some of our old podcasts. If you have, I know you haven't done them all. There's a few people that have, but when you get time, do them all. You know, I got an email. Yeah, it was an email from a friend of mine that still works actively in the intelligence unit, and he said, Gary, thanks a lot for recording all those podcasts. They make a nighttime surveillance go much better. So that's quite a compliment there coming from a guy that's really doing it, that he likes our podcast, Aaron.
He's actually an officer, uniformed officer.
No, he's not uniformed. He's an intelligence unit, just like I was. Matter of fact, whenever I want to know something, why I will call him up. Like I had a call from a guy we're going to get on here, Scott Bernstein from Detroit. And Scott called me and asked me a question about somebody in the Kansas City family and kind of some more current information. So I was able to call this guy up, and he was able to find out what I needed to know. It wasn't any kind of a big secret. They won't give me any big secrets, and I wouldn't ask him to, but it's more like a general piece of information that anybody could find out, but it was hard to find out, and he knew right off the top of his head. So got to keep those contacts in law enforcement. I know this Dave guy, Dave Stratweiser, he's got a bunch of buddies in law enforcement. He said he had a few. He's got a bunch of buddies in law enforcement. You can't be that successful reporting on the mob without having some good deep throat sources inside the intelligence units and the State Patrol intelligence and the FBI organized crime squad.
Yeah, but working in news, TV news, they know your face. And I thought it was the question I was trying to ask him that I never quite got in there. And then he continued on, and that didn't seem like worth coming back to, was him talking about doing some sort of investigative, like undercover reporting.
You know, I wanted to get that back to that, too. We may have to get back to that.
But that he was out in a
van,
a news van with, you know, microwave antennas and branding all over the sides of it.
It's he does that too, but I know I've seen him do that here. I know what he does actually. What they've done in Kansas City, they will send a photographer out in a plain van, and sit to get pic because they're always wanting pictures of these guys, you know, new pictures, recent pictures, pictures of them together. And then if a case breaks and they're all like indicted for something, then they can have these pictures already in hand, or maybe, you know, they may have some informant. Like I think I may have even said this on the podcast once. With Bill Norton, they were monitoring a restaurant here in Kansas City, and this is when he talks about doing undercover work. And they were monitoring a restaurant here in Kansas City that some mob guys, some city politicians, there was a particular banker here in town that was pretty well known at the time, and they were all showing up periodically. They were showing up every Sunday, not everybody, not the same people every Sunday, but some mix of those people would show up and have breakfast and drink coffee every Sunday morning at this restaurant. So they went out. We were watching them, and one of our guys went up the alley on up about a half a block away, and then he calls back on the air, and he said, is that one of our guys with a camera up here? We said, no, we don't have anybody with a camera up there. And the guy was standing out next to a van. So he trying to get a little better shot of the front door. I think he was high enough up that he was still, you know, reasonably well concealed behind a sign. And he got the license number, and it came back to the Kansas City Star. And then Bill confirmed that they did do that kind of thing on that particular restaurant. So that's probably what he's talking about, more than likely. Anyhow, so I think we've done it. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.